Hello. This is the first Wednesday sermon for July 2020. It's slightly different from normal because of the COVID crisis. We're actually recording this indoors. The more of you who dispute my starting point, the better. Because I want to highlight a Christian theme which, during my lifetime, has been receding from view, at least in my denomination. So I feel. But if you see no such erosion where you worship, that's good. Then I'm not reminding you of a topic partially eclipsed. Instead, I'm celebrating it along with you. Not that it's lost its formal place in creeds, liturgies, and many hymns. It's still mentioned in sermons and Christian conversations. Yet its weight and extent aren't fully appreciated, nor its uniqueness, nor its practical relevance. What was, till recently, such a vivid doctrine seems to be shrinking and fading. How much prominence it's lost particularly struck me during the corona crisis. Lockdown has affected everyone differently. Fortunately for me, it wasn't so difficult. And there was even a silver lining as I reread several Christian classics. In all of them, this topic conspicuously kept recurring. Two of the greatest are completely shaped by it, one vertically, the other horizontally. Dante's Divine Comedy ascends from the depths, then up a mountain and beyond. Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress traverses a country. Both are suffused with awareness. Our journeys are defined by where they end. Heaven is our goal. Heaven, our home, our true home, in the end our only home. Our calling and its transcendent consummation is heaven. Tell me, are we as mindful of that as all Christians were till recently? Incidentally, how many under 50s, even among churchgoers, know Pilgrim's Progress nowadays? Few, I suspect. Yet, at the start of the 20th century, it was reckoned the most read book in English after the Bible. Of course, that statistic doesn't by itself prove my point that the doctrine is neglected, but it is a pointer. What Bunyan's horizontal picture portrays, perhaps better than Dante, is that heaven is our destination. Both writers are equally effective in warning, though, that's not naturally so, not inevitably, only if we commit to Christ. And Dante's vertical imagery conveys, perhaps better than Bunyan, that it's not just a destination. That's a very shrunken understanding. It's each Christian's destiny, in a double sense, because it is God's design for us, and because, quite as amazing as going to heaven, is the fact we are going to become heavenly. St. Paul tells us we will put on our heavenly dwelling, be further clothed, in place of lowly mortal bodies, have spiritual bodies. Moreover, they will be like Christ's glorious body. And not only our bodies will be changed, we will be, into a higher degree of glory, into his very likeness. Redemption will be completed, crowned by our coming to resemble God's Son. We are to be transfigured, transformed, as the children's hymn says, to fit us for heaven, to live with thee there. Eternal life isn't a mere extension in quantity. It's the utmost elevation in quality. Isn't now an opportune, needful time to sound that note loud and clear? Increasingly, in recent decades, books, films, reports from remote places paraded death, but in ways that almost fictionalized it, while the reality society increasingly sought to conceal. Now, suddenly, the virus has sprung mortality out from the wings to command center stage every single day. Yet, I know some churches strangely shy of proclaiming Jesus has drawn death's sting, reversed the grave's apparent victory, and that departed Christians are, as the Salvation Army says, promoted to glory. Instead, I'm hearing a lot about hope, for getting back to what was thought normal. However, all earthly hopes, whether frustrated or achieved, either way dissolve away. The only hope which abides is the one realized in heaven, and is in heaven realized eternally. Here we have no abiding city. So seek the heavenly one to come, of which glorious things are spoken, or should be. I also hear of the need to help people less able to cope, as of course is right. A subsidiary meaning of the New Testament word koinonia is obligation to give practical help. I've misgivings, though, when fashionable churchmen invoke the word to endorse community in some vague but clearly mundane sense. St. Paul's prime aim was to press on towards the goal for the prize of the upward call, our commonwealth in heaven. Community mustn't be mistaken for, cannot substitute for, the communion of saints. What's been commendable during the crisis are the efforts, using various means, to keep in touch with congregations while buildings were prohibited. Photos of them standing empty, especially at Easter and Whitsun, were shocking, but salutary too. A graphic reminder, the true church is those people who will be gathered, not after the crisis, but hereafter. That's what should direct our efforts. One thoroughly practical reason to anticipate heaven's church triumphant is to put in perspective the earthly church militant and its activities. I dare say, I don't at all doubt, my reservations are shared by more than a few members of my denomination, which possibly may improve when the pandemic's immediate challenges are met. But meanwhile, it's mystifying that heaven is being kept up the denomination's sleeve rather than worn on it. Maybe my generation heeded too much the old Marxist reproach directed at mid-20th century Christians in this country, that we're too preoccupied with pie in the sky, too heavenly minded to be of earthly use. The slur never was fair. Besides, pie in the sky is Beulah land, nothing less than the wedding feast of the Lamb. Shouldn't we think of the very thing that creation was made for? Admittedly, relatively little has been revealed about heaven, and some of that is couched in imagery. That its streets are pure gold and transparent as glass communicates something of its beauty, but cannot be a physical description. Not that we ought to expect ordinary physical descriptions, not when it's obvious that matter and time won't be as simple as they are in this world. On some issues that occur to us, we can only speculate. On some, we can't even do that, not from our present position and present parameters. But none of those are reasons to disregard what we do know, quite the reverse. For while the amount may seem little, the import is stupendous. Let me summarize, putting things into four points. Think how impoverished we'd be if any of these four points hadn't been revealed. First and foremost, Jesus is the door. It's thanks to him we enter heaven, for he is there, and where he is, there we will also be, in places he has prepared for us. And there, collectively, we'll be bride to his bridegroom. Second, we've touched on this, we shall be purged, purified, perfected, and additionally shall become Christ-like. And while his glory will be preeminent, we'll be granted a share in it. We will be showered with a weight of glory. Third, we shall see God unveiled, face to face, both know him and be known by him, as he confides to each of us our true individual name, and collectively we'll respond to his worth, worshipping like a temple of living stones. Fourth, we will judge angels, rule cities, and, with all tears past, experience being a kingdom of righteousness, peace, and joy, unremitting joy. You'll notice no mention of the Last Judgment, because it's implicit in the first point, Jesus being the door, and is prior to heaven. It is, in effect, a final publication and confirmation of what we choose now. We can remain self-centered with self-destructive consequences, or we can take up God's offer of a new type of life mediated through his Son. Accept, and there's no fear of condemnation. Take Jesus's hand, and he leads into heaven, since his advocacy consists of including us with him. That's how God's purpose of saving us was realized. I also didn't mention merit. The parable of the sheep and goats is badly misunderstood if careless readers imagine Jesus' criteria is what we do and to whom. That's so only indirectly, insofar as our actions are or aren't done to Jesus, not in person, but whether or not done in his spirit. In the parable, both those who inherit the kingdom, as well as those who don't, insist it's not a result of their deeds. So it's not a matter of merit. Inheritance isn't. Inheritance follows from relatedness, our being related in this case to the kingdom's king. Yet Jesus repeatedly promised extravagant rewards and recompenses. Does that imply merit? Does it imply and invite mercenary motives, making the desire for heaven a sort of disguised selfishness, thereby disqualifying us? Not at all. For, as Jesus constantly stressed, since God is loving, it is his nature to give. The rewards he gives are entirely given, not earned. What's rewarded is simply our being open to God, the giver. Nothing more is required, but also nothing less. The irrelevance of merit is underlined by the summary's second point, our being elevated, which also contradicts the idea, sometimes heard, that heaven is a restoration, like returning to Eden before the fall. Besides being a diminution, that's a serious distortion of the doctrine. For if all God does is remove sin, there's a real question mark against his having permitted it. But heaven provides complete vindication, since our future template isn't the first Adam, either fallen or unfallen, it's the second Adam. So the fall actually leads, via redemption, to our joining and being joined to our Redeemer, becoming more than human. The new creation isn't old creation renewed, it's creation lifted up to a new level, in which we're no longer just creatures, we're brethren to the uncreated Son. The presence of the Holy Spirit is already a guarantee that God gives us himself. The summary's third point, receiving our true names, is that we are also given ourselves. In the incarnation, Jesus' humanity wasn't stifled or swamped. His humanity, in response to the Logos, was perfected. We, similarly, once responsive to God, begin to be genuinely ourselves, truly individuals, once sin with its self-contradictory consequences no longer has dominion over us. Sinners, in the end, are indistinguishable from their sins, whereas each saint becomes unique. There's no place, though, for complacency or self-satisfaction. We are free from sin's rule, but not yet sinless, and heaven requires we must be. Even if it feels like being maimed, sin must be cut away. We have to be healthy. So, the more we cooperate now with the Holy Spirit's sanctifying purposes, the more prepared we'll be. How exactly any shortfall at the time of our deaths is addressed isn't agreed by all Christians. Personally, I think the notion of purgatory lacks sufficient biblical basis. I think the sight of God will act as refining fire in those who have come to love him. But either way, residual sins will be extinguished and only good remain in us. After all, we're called to be saints, no two precisely alike. And if that implies differences of degree between us, none will mind. In fact, it'll be wonderful. It's not a competition, and each will be blessed to his or her entire capacity. On top of being given God himself and being given ourselves, we also inherit the earth, or all we valued on earth. Everyone is touched by value and beauty, but what's revealing is that we don't all locate it in the same things, because it's not inherent in those things, it's glimpsed through them. Its real origin is God. Once face to face with God, we'll encounter all we've loved, directly at source, freed from imperfections. Encounter it not as inanimate articles or activities, but in a living relationship. So I wonder, what will heaven include for you? Remember, blessed also means happy. So it's not restricted to being solemn. Fun and pleasure are sure to be included. Karl Barth said he'd listen to Bach with Mozart in the morning. Sidney Smith anticipated pâté de foie gras to the sound of trumpets. The writer to the Hebrews loved the covenant and Jerusalem, but was aware they never had met the mark. Yet he foresaw that in heaven he'd find all his longings mended and amended, perfected, since God is the judge who puts all to right. Here, the writer to the Hebrews' excitement mounting as he looks ahead to Mount Zion and the city of the living God, heavenly Jerusalem, with innumerable angels in festal gathering, and assembled the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and a judge who is God of all things, and the spirits of just men made perfect, and Jesus, mediator of a new covenant, sprinkled blood, speaking more graciously than the blood of Abel. If anything, you know, he's understating. Heaven's actuality surpasses our experiences and aspirations, surpasses it to such an extent that St. Paul insists, eyes have not seen, nor ears heard, nor hearts conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. Consider how two things, presently the most important things, will become unrecognizably transformed. Morality and religion, as we know them now, will be redundant. The negative, restraining aspects unnecessary, and the positive aspects transcended. After all, what will morality be when we are actually good? What will religion be when we're actually enjoying God and his blessings directly? Yes, the writer to the Hebrews is right. What we've loved will be fulfilled. And St. Paul is also right. They'll be so utterly fulfilled that real religion and morality and whatever else we've loved, we've not seen, not yet. The summary's fourth and final point, the realization of the kingdom of heaven, shows the same pattern. Peace and righteousness will no longer be negatively defined as an absence of strife or eschewing unrighteousness and self-righteousness, and their positive aspects will be lifted into a new dimension in which peace won't simply be a neutral state, but an active relationship. Righteousness won't simply be a healthy regime, but an active relationship. Both relationships stemming from God's kingship, his rule exercised in loving us and our loving in return. And notice how this completes all the promises in the Sermon on the Mount's Beatitudes. Having obtained mercy, we become sons of God, comforted, inheriting the earth, greatly rewarded, all hunger and thirst for righteousness satisfied, residing in the kingdom of heaven, seeing God. The rest of the summary's fourth point, I'm afraid, is rather beyond me. If it's meant literally, I can't see how. Heaven is a single celestial city. So what cities will we rule? And whom will we rule when everyone is already governed by God's love? Judging devils, we leave to God. But why would we presume to judge angels, perfect in obedience, and who rejoiced when we repented? I'm guessing part of the explanation is that it's meant retrospectively, referring back to the present. Angels, according to the traditional theories, serve different functions. Guardian angels nurture individuals, others supervise nations or natural laws. Yet, in the here and now, the ups and downs of life often perplex us. We do learn to appreciate God's purpose isn't to provide ordinary prosperity now, it's to make us into saintly souls, a process in which difficulties and disasters can be positive. But while we confidently trust that's so, still at present it is often perplexing. Once in heaven, however, we will see that God indeed worked all things together for good. I'm guessing that our judging angels involves us in recognizing they exercised rightly their subsidiary roles in that, are recognizing they were always instruments for good, no matter how ambiguous events might have seemed at the time. In that way, angels will be justified, just as the writer to the Hebrews will rule that the flawed city of Jerusalem, despite appearances, was nevertheless leading, under God's providence, towards Mount Zion in heaven. Our perplexities and the tears they've occasioned will thus be wiped away, supplanted by sheer joy. It can't have escaped you. The common core in all these points is Christ's bringing us to be with God the Father. Jews constantly called God holy, so it's unsurprising Jesus did. The surprise is how often? Just once. And then in prayer, not in public. So seldom, probably because for Jews, very conscious of the gulf between us and God, for Jews, holiness had connotations of separation. That's why they often used circumlocutions instead of the word God. And it's why they described the biblical text as defiling the hands, because it exposed our being tainted. But Jesus would not endorse that outlook, since his very purpose was to end separation from God. And since, if we turn to Jesus, sin cannot separate us from God, death certainly won't. Life won't be swallowed up in death. It is mortality that will be swallowed up in life. An eternally loving God does not love us temporarily. The shorter Westminster Catechism begins famously by declaring our chief end is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Were the Catechism a little longer, it might have added, as wonderfully, that our chief end is also to be glorified by God and be enjoyed by him forever in heaven.